welcome to Real Talk. This is the show on Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSH LP Vashon Island, Washington, where we talk about anything that piques my curiosity or yours. And I was recently fascinated when I learned that the Earth Day Network is hosting a March for Science, Not Silence. And that's going to happen this weekend, April 22nd or April 23rd, I'm not sure which, in Washington, D.C. and other countries, other cities around the country. And I am happy to welcome our guest, Kathleen Rogers, who is the president of Earth Day Network. Welcome, Kathleen. Can you hear us?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's really wonderful.
I know that you are doing whirlwind interviews around the country for this march. First of all, I'd like to say a little bit about you. You spent 20 years as an environmental attorney and advocate focused on international and domestic environmental policy and law. You've been leading the Earth Day Network for how long?
Almost 13 years.
Wow. You know, I saw your photo. You don't look old enough to be doing anything for 13 years.
I know, that's a really good picture of me. I don't know. I'm going to use it till I'm 90. My hair looks great.
Some of us do
rare occasions.
Yes, right. And now Earth Day Network reaches 192 countries?
Well, we actually think we're about 194 now. We did a count. Some of them I never heard of, but and need to know more about. But Earth Day is pretty ubiquitous and everywhere. We now have 3 offices in India, for example. So Earth Day is growing exponentially worldwide.
Tell us a little bit more about the Earth Day Network mission. What is it you are about, and how do you do it?
Well, we grew out of the first Earth Day, and Gaylord Nelson, who was the founder of Earth Day, and Dennis Hayes, who was the organizer of Earth Day and who actually took it worldwide, were engaged with Earth Day when I was first hired. Excuse me, Dennis is still the chair of Earth Day, and he runs a foundation, actually, in Seattle.
Yes.
So, Dennis, if you're listening, I hope I'm doing a good job.
That's the Bullitt Foundation.
Mission, yes, and he also built the greenest building in the world. If you haven't seen it, it's really worth touring. And so Dennis and Gaylord hired me end of 2001, and I've seen a truly exponential growth of Earth Day worldwide, I think, because as the world becomes more globalized and communications become obviously global in matter of seconds, Earth Day has gained traction around the world, particularly in the developing world, where movement building is central to building a robust, educated electorate that is also engaged in community actions. And so Earth Day serves a very useful purpose, not just as a single day, but as a galvanizing moment when people come together. Institutions grow out of the first Earth Day. We've seen quite a number of major institutions around the world. Actually, their charter date is Earth Day because they came together and recognized the potential to have an impact year-round and not just during a single day or week or month.
So tell us about your focus right now, which is this march that is happening. Is it Saturday on the actual Earth Day, or is it Sunday?
It is on Saturday, which is Earth Day.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting sort of background on this is that Earth Day Network picks a theme every year for Earth Day. And this year we picked global climate, environment, and science literacy. And so when we heard about the March for Science and they came to us, we recognized that we would be able to align ourselves with the concept of a March for Earth Day and then employ it worldwide. We also decided to take on, which we often do, the central event, which is on the National Mall on the 22nd, and it will be held from 10 to 2, and then there will be a march after that, beginning about 2 or 2:15.
What was the impetus for this theme?
Well, you know, for many, many years, Earth Day Network has been engaged in promoting environment and climate literacy. It is sort of the mainstay of what we do. It's central to our largest campaign, which is around green schools. But we recognized, and Dennis is a funder through the Bullet Organization, but I think he would agree that environmental education has been the sort of sad stepchild of the environmental movement. And so we decided, and this is true at the end of the Obama administration, we began to see that funders and other people were really interested in promoting it because we recognize we do not have a strong environmental movement if we're not engaging people through education at the K through 12 and university level. So we decided that the time was right to create a global plan for climate and environmental literacy. We're actually having more luck outside the United States than we are inside the United States, where Oman, Morocco, Italy, Nicaragua, many, many countries are talking about how they can engage their population. And so school boards and educators are gathering to create curricula and mandatory environment and climate literacy requirements to graduate from high school. In the United States, we have 50 separate environmental literacy plans, which means each state does their own thing. Those plans were written by volunteers. And so we're hoping that, and maybe the time isn't right because of the new administration. I think many might agree with me.
Yeah.
But we were looking at a real momentum around creating viable climate and environment standards so that we can engage students not just to learn the facts and not just to internalize the values, although both of those are quite important, but to educate our kids and our consumers around the concept of green jobs, which, as I think most people would agree, it is inevitable that we will be growing the green economy, and eventually it will become a replacement for the Industrial Revolution, which served our country well until the pollution and other issues associated with fossil fuels overwhelmed our capacity. So that's the real reason that we decided to engage in it. We did have momentum coming out of the Obama White House, but now that's changed. How much? We'll see, but it's not looking particularly good. Some states have already banned climate education. West Virginia and a few of the sort of hardcore Western states have taken it out of the curricula. So that's disappointing, but I think it's just two steps forward, one step back, and the trajectory we're on is inevitable.
Kind of a sad state of affairs that the United States is behind other countries right now in environmental education. I want to ask you about, clearly you started planning this march, was it before the administration banned or was reducing the funding from EPA?
No, the idea didn't come up. That's what's so flabbergasting about how much momentum we have, is the idea, which was literally a couple of people online creating a website and a URL, came up with the idea to do a march for science. It followed on the heels of the idea on the Women's March, which, as you know, was enormously popular.
Right.
I was there in D.C. They set a whole new bar for crowds. It was way over a million people.
It was true here in Seattle as well.
Yeah, it was huge. So these young scientists thought, well, why not them? And then we decided to become engaged because of our sort of intersection of climate science and environmental literacy. And so we took on the task of putting together biggest event, which is in D.C., but we've also been engaged in sort of converting a lot of what would normally be Earth Day events into March for Science / Earth Day events, and then there are lots of events around the country that organically grew. So we're working with the March for Science scientists, and we're raising the money and putting on the event. We have really great speakers. It will be streamed worldwide. We're going to integrate what's going on in other marches around the world so we can incorporate that, other Earth Day events. So I think it'll be a great intersection of environment, climate values, and then just a love of science, because, as you know, our country was built on great science. Abraham Lincoln started the National Academy of Sciences. He didn't just sign the legislation. He was a huge player in the creation of that. So was Thomas Jefferson in terms of, incorporating science even into our Constitution. So we have a long history in the United States of supporting and caring about science and scientists, and certainly the Industrial Revolution was built on that. The problem now is this incredible attack on the integrity and truth-telling of scientists. I was on a radio show earlier listening to this really incredible scientist who was talking about data and biases and all the step-by-step processes he uses when he creates and works on a scientific project. These guys aren't working for the big bucks, right? They're in their labs. They're working on projects. They're looking for funding. They're trying to prove it, but they don't have these kinds of biases. And now everything about their lives is under attack. But I think they're willing to work for government salaries and lower paid salaries on these projects because they really care about the outcome. And so when you call that into question, when you call people liars, especially people who devote their lives specifically to finding the truth, it's not a good idea. And so scientists are angry and upset and willing to come out and take an extra step. I must say that the idea that there are no politics in science is kind of silly. Everybody votes. Everybody has an opinion. And so it's not that we're politicizing or making science political. It's that the scientists want to get engaged in the political process because they don't enjoy being called names. So, they don't enjoy having their lives being called into question.
So tell us exactly what this march is going to look like on Saturday. Who's involved? Are there going to be people in lab coats? What exactly is going to happen?
Well, as I said, from 10 to 2, we'll be presenting lots of different opinions from the stage. It's very well organized. I don't know whether it was Dennis Hayes or I came up with the idea, but it's true, or the fact, let's call it the fact, that Abraham Lincoln was able to deliver the Gettysburg Address in 2 minutes and 17 seconds. So we won't have long speeches. We've encouraged everybody to read that and time themselves. And so everybody has a couple of minutes. We were inundated with speaker requests, and they were from, really famous scientists to people who just had great stories to tell. So it's going to be a combination of people telling different. Maya Lin, for example, is going to come and talk about climate, but her perspective on the world of infrastructure. She was the woman who, of course, created the Vietnam Memorial. And we have astronauts, and we have school teachers, and a wide variety of people who we are hopeful will know how to tell a great story. And then the people that are viewing it worldwide will sort of understand why we're there and what we're about. It's a First Amendment event, so I can't say it won't have any partisanship in it because our stage is built on the monument grounds, and when you're standing on it, you have this feeling, if you get a chance to come, that you're looking directly into the White House. So it's a pretty remarkable sort of geo location, and I think it will inspire a lot of people to not just get up and make a great speech, but to stay engaged in the process, because we need truth tellers, and I honestly believe our democracy, the American way of life, everything about us is built on science. In fact, the first Earth Day there would be no Earth Day but for scientists.
True, true. We're talking with Kathleen Rogers, president of the Earth Day Network, which is organizing, along with other folks, scientists specifically, the March for Science, Not Silence, which happens in Washington, D.C. on Earth Day, 10 to 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I'm wondering, Kathleen, what kind of response you're getting from the White House for this march?
Not much. I mean, I think we'll start. We were disappointed. We work with federal agencies every single year on Earth Day. The Army mm-hmm. takes our annual poster, EPA, NASA. They've all been really active participants, the State Department. It's a very different year this time, and it's really disappointing that the federal agencies would actually try to make Earth Day into something it isn't. And so we're hoping, federal scientists and other people will come out and show support for this kind of action, because, of course, their jobs and everything about them is under attack. But it's been largely silent from the White House, and sometimes that's a good thing. I think at this point we're all feel like our heads are on swivel sticks. We don't know which way to turn next in response to this sort of social media. So while we're not expecting complete silence, we've had a reprieve for a while, so we'll see what happens on Saturday.
What are you hearing from members of Congress, from the House and the Senate? Anyone involved helping you out?
Well, we've tried to stay away from what I call, that's real partisan politics. So lots of members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, wanted to come and speak, and we turned them all down. We do not want this to be a partisan event. And as a C3, which we are, we stay away from partisan politics. We're allowed to be political, but we can't be partisan. So we turned everybody down, and there were lots and lots of requests. So a lot of members of Congress will be back in their districts. It's a four-day weekend. They'll certainly be aware of the March for Science events and the Earth Day events in their local communities. But for the most part, we've steered clear of that, again, have avoided being the sort of recipient or object of, the climate denier types or the people who want to rush drugs to market or who don't believe in science generally. But it's they've been largely quiet, and we're kind of grateful for that.
Well, good. That's impressive. So what do you hope will result from this march? What are you looking for?
Well, Earth Day Network's mission is to diversify the movement. So our goal, scientists as writ large probably have an entirely different goal, but ours is to add that constituency to a growing global movement. We can't build a green world if we don't have scientists, and if we don't have the investment of scientists who aren't just doing what they can raise money to do, but are taking an active position on what the next great invention will be. And I think that's the most important thing for me, is that we want scientists to actively promote advances in medicine, astrophysics, in math, and in the green economy. And we need to work together on those issues in order to make our community more robust, more active. And so we have the backing of the people who actually do the hardcore research and who bet their lives on their own integrity and their ability to sit quietly, sift through the facts and the science and the data, and come up with something that's provable. So we're really anxious for this new constituency to get involved, and I guess that's what I hope for more than anything.
Let me ask you something, because earlier in our discussion, you mentioned that Earth Day Network is working toward developing jobs in the green economy that might even eclipse those jobs that we've lost, this is a paraphrase, from the Industrial Revolution. What areas do you see those jobs occurring in, and what sort of timeline do you see this eclipse occurring?
Well, just to give you some perspective, currently the solar industry, and I don't think this even includes wind, but the solar industry now has more jobs and people employed than the oil, gas, and coal industries combined. And that's a government study from last year. It's not Earth Day Networks. I see exponential growth worldwide. We still have 400 million people in India alone with no electricity at all. That means when the sun goes down, it's pitch black. So those people could benefit from, you know, who wants to build old-fashioned infrastructure with stripping, you know, power lines across a country when you can create distributed energy grids so that people can produce and take care of their energy locally, and it can grow as they grow. All of this is going to take not just existing technology, but it's going to take the backing of scientists, entrepreneurs, governments to get the job done. But it starts with having the scientific capability of doing that. And so I'm not sure who in their right mind would promote dirty fossil fuels when everything from how it's extracted, how it's disposed of, how it's burned, the impact on children's health. I mean, it served a great purpose, and now it's time for it to go. And so as we phase it out, and I don't think it's going to happen overnight, we need to have the industry behind it. It could be the diversification of the oil industry. They finally, you know, see the handwriting on the wall, and they do something else. But there are lots of brainy scientists that work inside oil companies, and we'd love nothing better than for them to get engaged in the green economy. So I see it on a slow but steady trajectory, even with Donald Trump in the White House. And then I see, once everybody wises up, I see it just exponentially growing. And not, again, not just in energy, but in biology and physics and everywhere else, as we try and recreate this world and feed people, clothe them in a way that's sustainable, and eventually phase out dirty energy.
That is a tall order. That's like turning the behemoth 100 degrees. 180 degrees, rather. How do you keep up your energy, Kathleen Rogers?
Probably too much coffee. I don't know, my kids. I think maybe I was born this way. I do have a lot of energy, and many of the people in our community have the same kind of level of energy. It's a challenge. You know, I call us all pathologically optimistic because we sort of persevere and carry on even when a big wall is built in front of our face sort of overnight, as was during the election. But I don't see too much pessimism in my community. I see, if anything, even more energy and more interest with from a growing number of people to not just protect what Dennis Hayes and Gaylord Nelson were able to achieve in the 70s after the first Earth Day, because really the groundwork was laid by both of them,
yes.
But also the incredible work that's happened in the last 47 years. And so there are those people that are in the business of protecting things, and then there's a huge group of us that are still looking forward and working on legislation, proposed regulations, and science, that builds towards a future that's a lot greener. As I said, it's a big world. It's not just what's happening in the U.S., but we do have a disproportional impact when it comes to negativity, so we're fighting those inclinations as well.
How do you see the Paris Accords going forward if the U.S. backs out? How do you see that affecting the progress?
You know, the first anniversary of the climate agreement, they opened it for signing, was on Earth Day in New York. I was there. It was an incredible moment in time. All these countries all getting up and talking about Earth Day and their future. And these were little countries that were poor and big rich countries and totalitarian countries. And everybody got up and talked about the Green Revolution and the importance of the climate agreement. Yesterday, Tuesday in D.C., there was this big, widely anticipated meeting of people inside the Trump administration, and there was an idea at that time, and of course circulated widely and wildly, that Trump would pull out of the Paris Agreement yesterday. The meeting was canceled for some reason. I think logistics was the reason that they gave. But the timing would have been really bad right before the anniversary. It would be like sort of getting divorced on your wedding anniversary. But it was, they didn't carry it forward. You know, we're hearing that some people inside the administration don't see any reason to drop out of the climate agreement because it'll make us look really bad. And then there are two subsets of that. There are the people that say we shouldn't drop out because it's good for the economy. And then there are other people inside the administration, the sort of creepier, more nefarious type, that say we shouldn't drop out of the Paris Agreement, but we can kill it by getting rid of the Obama's clean power plan and improvements in automobile efficiency standards. And so it's like, you know, a million dying by a million cuts or whatever the expression is. And so inside the let's not drop out are two different opposing views. One that say, let's stay and try and make it work and figure something out so the U.S. isn't quote-unquote disadvantaged, which of course we're not. There's no enforceability clause in it. And then there are those who say, let's stay in, pretend, and let's kill it in some other way.
Well, Kathleen Rogers, you and Earth Day Network have your work cut out for you, as I can see, as we can all see, and we're grateful for all the effort that you're putting into it. Kathleen Rogers is president of Earth Day Network. She and her band of environmentalists are organizing the March for Science, Not Silence, which is happening in Washington, D.C. And quickly, Kathleen, how many other places?
Oh, there are many, many places. There are super organized marches in four or five other cities, but we actually have lots of events going on worldwide. We have one really sweet event in India where we have 200 million school children who are going to be learning about climate, and then they're going to march around their classrooms with little March for Science placards. So those are the kinds of things that are really extraordinary because they reach into everyday people who just want to learn, people who want to get jobs in the future. So those are my favorite ones, but I guess we'll see the big ones too.
We will. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk
Thanks
with us
for
here
having,
on Real
having
Talk.
Me. It was really nice.
Thank you so much. And
okay, bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. It is my pleasure now to introduce a new feature on Real Talk, and that is Mary Fran Lyons. She's going to do some book reviews for us. Welcome, Mary Fran.
Thank you for having me.
What's the book today?
The book today is named Slaves in the Family, and it's by a gentleman by the name of Edward Ball. And it's kind of a big book, but a lot of times I get a hold of a book and I just rip through it because I just get so engrossed in it. This is not a book that you read fast, but it is a book that has a lot in it and is extremely rewarding. So I'll tell you a little bit about John Ball and what he did. So he is the descendant of a South Carolina family that made its fortune, and I think its fortune's pretty much gone at this point, which is why he needed a job and wrote a book. But its fortunes were built on selling slaves. And South Carolina was really the epicenter of the slave trade in North America. And so he made a decision to go back through the records of his family, and he had those available to them because the family was, of course, very impressed with itself and its genealogy and all of this. And he went back and delved into the records and figured out who some of the slaves were, and then concentrated on some of the slaves that would have been the, in most instances, matriarchs or patriarchs in the slave culture. And then he went back and traced where those slaves wound up and where their descendants were. And he went and knocked on the doors of their descendants and said hello and said, oh, this is who I am. Can we talk to find out how they are doing?
Wow.
And shockingly, in most instances, he was quite well received by the black people. Many people in his family were not very happy about this project upon which he embarked, because it's certainly sort of at least embarrassing and it minimally politically incorrect these days. So he wrote this book about all of this, which is, as I said, long but very rewarding. And then probably the thing that was so intriguing to me is at the end of the book, he writes about going to Africa, Sierra Leone, to talk with some of the blacks who had sold their neighbors and the villagers down the road into slavery in the first place. And his question for them, of course, was, well, why? So he talked with them about why, and economics there, just as here, are major drivers. But one of the most interesting things about this book is, you know, there's no huge plot here that I'm giving away, but you certainly come away from the book realizing that the color of your skin has very little to do with how much badness you may or may not have. Your character is the determinant of how you comport yourself in life. And there's some really, really special people that he calls out in this book.
How many generations back did he have to go among the slave community and his own family?
So I don't know if I read it with that sort of a magnifying glass on the actual generations, but certainly since the Civil War, you could be talking about anywhere from 3 to 6 generations, depending on how early women had children, and there's a lot of people that did not leave the area. You know, slaves sort of, they're kind of like the rest of us. They like to hang around your home. And so there were a number of people who had stayed in the general area, which made it easier for him to track them down.
What kind of questions did he ask these slave descendants?
He asked some questions about what they knew about their past and, of course, how they were doing in life. And really, I think, wanted to have a mature adult discussion with them about the fact that, actually, in some instances, they share common ancestry, because many of the blacks are actually his distant relatives.
Sure.
Hence the name Slaves in the Family. Mm-hmm. They share common ancestors because so many of the slaves were fathered by masters and white men.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these people that he went to talk to actually were relatives. Not all of them, but many of them were. So common heritage and just reaching out to them.
Fascinating. So what it says is how slavery impacts black families today.
Correct. What do they know? What was it like? There are many stories in black families that really is oral history that's been passed down from generation to generation about what happened and who did what and where they came from and this sort of thing. Some of it, of course, now with the whole DNA analysis, you know, can be a surprise to people. But yeah. I don't think he got any surprises. He did his homework and he knew who he was talking to and he knew where the intersections were and all of that. And many of the people that he spoke with were sincerely appreciative of him coming to reach out to them to say, you know,
just to get the truth.
Correct. Get mm-hmm. the truth, say it the way it really was, you know, and just lay it out. But not so much as relatives, his white relatives, I should say.
They didn't want the truth. Yeah.
No.
Truth hurts.
No.
Once again, Mary Fran Lyons on literature. The book is Slaves in the Family, and the author is?
Edward Ball.
Edward Ball.
Spelled just the way you would think.
That's Lyons on Literature as part of Real Talk. Thanks for listening.